everybody, and welcome. This is episode 320 of Milwaukee's Tailgate Brewers podcast, part of the MKE Tailgate Network. I'm James, joined by Ryan, and pinch hitting for Paul this week. Again, we've got Spencer Michaelis joining us. Spencer, how's your weekend been?
Pretty good. I'm just very busy right now, just with coaching stuff. We're practicing every day. We play next Saturday, though, so I'm excited to get an actual game in here soon. But yeah, otherwise, pretty good.
Nice. Yeah, we're catching you up before a Sunday night practice here, so we'll hopefully record this quick and get you on your way so you can get to practice.
Yeah, so how does that work? Like, where do you guys play early in the season?
We're going to be going down to kind of southern Illinois this next weekend.
Okay.
It's supposed to be in like the 40s or 50s, which honestly, for our season, that's pretty good. And then we'll be in like middle of Illinois the next weekend. And then we have our Florida trip over spring break, which is the week after that. So that's how we get in like a quarter of our season, get it in right, so that we can hopefully when we get back from Florida, it'll be warm enough to play baseball here.
Yeah, that was always my thing about like when people talk about bringing the Badger baseball program back. It's like, well, really, the first quarter of the season to third of the season is all spent on the road, because you really just can't play baseball in Wisconsin in February and well into March. And even then, it's touch and go. I played golf in high school, and there were years where like we were not able to do much of anything practice wise, even into April, because the courses were flooded and just, you know, it was so crappy out there. There'd be snow. Like, yeah, you'd just be really limited on what you could do. So I always wondered about that.
Yeah, I mean, look at the Badgers women's softball team. A lot of Florida trips, Arizona trips, Texas trips, that kind of thing. And even my alma mater, I went to Hofstra out on Long Island. They've got a baseball team. But again, likewise, a lot of Southeast play going on before you get into May. So, but yeah, definitely cool to see baseball seasons of all kinds rubbing up. You know, we got pitchers and catchers reporting this past week. People playing out of position already. We've got some questions about that. Ryan's all riled up about that. But a reminder to get question priority, and we've got a ton of questions again this week. Go to patreon.com/MKETailgate. $2 a month guarantees you get those questions answered both on this podcast and on reporting as eligible. $5 gets you the question priority plus the additional exclusive content, including the minor league extra with Ryan and James Anderson from RotoWire. Even if you're not a patron, go support us another way for free. Go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to us. You can give us a 5-star review there as well. We greatly appreciate that. So, you know, as I mentioned, pitchers and catchers reported in this past week. And, you know, even though they didn't need to be there until Monday, it sounds like almost all the position players were in camp by the weekend as well. So that's really good to see. You know, the Brewers, of course, no strangers to thinking outside the box when it comes to positional versatility and defensive alignments. Looks like we might have another case. Sal Frelick reportedly planning on getting some time in the infield this spring. We have a couple of questions about that, so let's just dive in with those Patreon questions. First, we have Elvis Peguero enthusiast asking, Ken Rosenthal's latest article for The Athletic discusses Dustin Pedroia training Sal Frelick to play infield this offseason. What are your thoughts on the idea of Sal getting playing time at third or second, considering how excellent of an outfielder he already is? Also, how does this story affect a guy like Tyler Black, who seems to be getting logjammed from the opportunity of being a true starting infielder? So, Ryan, I mentioned you have some thoughts first on Ken Rosenthal being the one to write this article, but also, you know, the possibility of seeing you know, Sal Frelick get some innings, at least in spring training, in the infield after getting some off-season workouts with his childhood idol, Dustin Pedroia.
Yeah, I mean, first off, this article isn't written by Ken Rosenthal unless it's Dustin Pedroia. If this is some rando person, I severely doubt this article gets written by him. Now, obviously, Sal Frelick working out, and especially if he gets into games in the infield during spring training, that would get extensive coverage from our local beat reporters, you know, Kurt and Todd, and actually I should mention Adam McAlvey is on the IL to start the season after having some from surgery. So it sounds like they're going to have somebody else covering for him on MLB.com, but it's going to be a bit before he's totally back out there. He had some eye surgery just a few weeks ago, I guess. So hopefully Adam is recovering well, and we hope he gets back soon. He's kind of, he's now the dean, really, of Brewers beat writers. He's been around longer than anybody. He goes back to Ned Yost, famously, with
his
picture in
there. He's the old guy on the beat now.
Yeah, he is.
I'm sure he'll love hearing that. Yeah. Absolutely.
So if he listens, I have no idea if Adam McAlvey listens. I have no indication of that whatsoever. But yeah, this thing seems like it's mostly a tempest in a teapot, because first off, this was tried. So it wasn't actually tried at Boston College, which is where Sal Frelick went to college. But it was tried in his summer league. And he got extensive time. He played 24 games at shortstop, another dozen or so at second base, even got in a few games at third base, which is where we saw a video this weekend of him getting in. And I just am skeptical that this would be happening right now if it really was a thing that was going to take off. Part of it is he's an excellent outfielder, so there's no issue there. It's not like he's being moved because he can't hack it someplace else. It's more of a logjam, and logjams tend to sort themselves out over time. They don't tend to last forever. Everybody, when people get worried that you have too many good players to play a position, it usually doesn't stay that way for all that long. That's not a persistent problem. So I think that chances are, to the extent that we see this in the regular season, I would imagine it's probably going to be maybe he gets moved over there late in a game in order to accommodate, you know, a pinch hitting situation, something like that. I don't think we should necessarily expect him to all of a sudden be, I don't know, like the starting second baseman or something. I think that's extremely unlikely.
Spencer, I know you're a pitching coach by trade, but how difficult is it to train a guy to, you know, move to the infield from the outfield? I guess it helps he's super athletic, you know, famously all state quarterback and I think hockey player too. Yep. But you know, obviously there's footwork stuff, there's throwing, you know, the one clip the Brewers posted, he threw kind of wide to first base. So, mm-hmm. You know, work in progress. But I guess how difficult of a transition is that for a guy?
Yeah, it's definitely, in my opinion, a lot easier to go from the infield to the outfield. I think there's just less you have to learn in the outfield in general. Now, the fact that he did spend some time, obviously it was just in summer ball, but we're only talking 3-4 years since the last time he would have been out there in summer ball. I believe the 2020 year is the last time he played out there in summer ball.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that he's probably pretty familiar with, and I was going to bring up the athleticism part of it. Every team I've been on or coached, there's always one guy that you could pretty much put anywhere and he will just figure it out. And while this is the major leagues, it's a lot different. I could see Frelick being that guy, being the one who just has the athleticism to just make it work at any spot you really put him at. But it's not easy. It's not easy to just move in to third. I'm surprised they're putting him on two different sides of the infield too for these reps. Like, to me, that was the hardest part as an infielder, was moving from the left side to the right side and vice versa. The ball comes off the bat so much different on the right side versus the left side, and that was the part that was hardest for me. I think, honestly, to me, this is, for the most part, just another sign in an offseason full of signs that they don't really trust or believe in Bryce Terang.
Exactly.
They've been picking up second baseman in almost every single move they've made this offseason. I mean, going back to Oliver Dunn, mm-hmm. Joey Ortiz, Christian Arroyo, now trying Frelick there. They talked about Tyler Black maybe playing some second. Like, almost everything they've done has shown that they don't really believe in Terang. And that's, to me, again, what this is. And like Ryan kind of hinted at, I think the logjam that people think we have in the outfield, I don't see all the young guys working out, especially right away. Mm-hmm. But if it does happen, I guess it's nice to have an option to try and get all of them in the lineup if they are all performing. So just giving themselves kind of flexibility, I think, is really the main goal here.
Yeah, I think that's fair. If it does end up working out that he moves in there, like, we shouldn't be stunned because, like you said, he is athletic and there's a little bit of history behind this, but I wouldn't go expecting this to be like some major sea change in what's going on with Sal Frelick. It seems incredibly unlikely that that would be the case, especially just because of how good he already is as an outfielder. Like, he's an above average defensive center fielder, and those aren't, you know, there are a lot of teams that would love to get one of those. In fact, we have a question coming up about that, so I'll just wait.
For sure. Real quick, though, you know, you guys mentioned Bryce Terang possibly getting squeezed out. The question does reference Tyler Black as well, who, you know, may have been slated in as possibly a third base option. Ryan, I know you kind of doubt his ability to play there just because of the arm. Does this affect his chances at all, or do you kind of expect similarly Tyler Black to kind of play all over the place?
Yeah, this doesn't change my outlook for Tyler Black one bit, because I don't think Sal Frelick is going to be chewing up anything other than maybe some late game substitutions over there. It would be a real upset if it was, you know, much more than that. So I don't think this changes the outlook for Tyler Black at all. But there are questions about exactly where Tyler Black's going to go, because the arm is not what you want at third base. So that is a limiting factor for him there, and I think may ultimately end up pushing him elsewhere, but we can hold off on that because we have questions about that too.
I was going to say, Keith Law thinks he can play the outfield, but we have a question about that later on too. So moving on, Morgoth10 asking, in honor of our new second baseman, Sal Frelick, what would be the worst possible defense you could set up with the current roster? So, you know, we had the big boy infield with Travis Shaw at second base a few years ago. Spencer, what's the worst defensive alignment for the Brewers you can think of on the infield?
On the infield, you got to, I mean, it's going to be Rhys Hoskins at first, unfortunately. He's not a very good defender. If you're going, I think I got to pick positions they actually played at one point, at least in the minors. So Monasterio's at short, Black's at third. And I guess I'm going to be allowed to use Frelick at second now.
Yeah.
So that's my pick.
Yeah. It then in the outfield, it's really just like, who are you? You know, Yelich is the left fielder. And that's not even bad. Like, yeah, Christian Yelich was legitimately one of the better left fielders in baseball last year. Sure. But it's really hard to come up with anything bad in the outfield, just because any sort of combination you'd put out there is going to be between very good and exceptional. So that's difficult to do anything. But yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's the worst combination, which goes to show, I mean, this team is extremely good defensively, potentially, you know, elite. And that's, they were elite last year, and I would anticipate them being, you know, pretty close to that again this year. Maybe even better because of some of these other changes. And that also makes it easier to be able to afford having somebody like Tyler Black at third base, because sure, he probably doesn't have the arm that you would want ideally there, but you could handle having a little bit of a defensive downgrade at some positions. You know, the corner infields, you can handle that if you're getting good offensive production for those guys. So if Black hits, I think he can potentially play third and it's okay.
I mean, how many starts did Monasterio get at third base last year? And he's got zero arm and was pretty bad or rough defensively there. So, Yeah, you know, that everything else is aces. So maybe that's just the one spot you just kind of take your lumps and get some offense. All right. That trade rumor you referenced, Jay Google asking, what do you make of the Frelick rumors of San Diego being interested? Who would they even look at in San Diego if those rumors were true? This is kind of like a weird one all around, because I don't know if the Padres are like itching for outfielders either, especially after moving Tatis to the outfield. But I don't know. Maybe.
Well,
I don't know what they got. What do you think, Ryan?
They did lose this offseason. You know, they traded away Juan Soto, and in that same deal, they sent out Trent Grisham. So they are.
That's true.
Yeah. Like, they are now kind of weak in the outfield from that perspective over there. So, but I mean, the thing about the Padres is a lot of what we would potentially want for him, I think, would be pitching. And I think they have their own pitching wants and desires that they would want. And I don't see them like Robbie Snelling and Dylan Lesko. They're not giving those guys up for self, right? Like, I don't think, I mean, maybe, I guess it's speculative, but the need the Brewers have is some impact pitching prospects. Like, that's what they sort of lack, is very good pitching prospects at the top end. They have kind of everything else that you could want in a minor league system, but they don't have near ready potential impact. They have more mid to back end guys, and then Mizrowski, who's, you know, potentially a reliever. So that part of it is what they lack. And I don't know, this seems like one of those things where it came from a San Diego beat writer, and the wording on it was the Padres have inquired or have been talking about or whatever,
showing interest in they're interested in self, right? Like a top 100 prospect. Yes.
Yeah. But it seems like usually, and I mentioned this on Twitter, like usually when, well, first off, when the Brewers make moves, there's generally not rumors ahead of time about them because the Brewers run an incredibly tight ship. So this seems like the kind of thing of somebody speaking out of school, probably down the decision tree a little bit in San Diego, running their mouth about this. And I would probably bet heavily against Frelich ending up being traded here, just because the fact that we heard it makes it, I guess, almost less likely that it would happen. Because leaks like this don't generally come when the Brewers are truly interested in doing stuff, right? Those things usually come quickly and out of nowhere.
Right. Even Corbin Burnes, you know, there were rumors flying early, and then we all thought we were past that, and then boom, he was traded out of nowhere. So yeah, exactly. All right, so let's move on. Another big point of discussion in this first week as camp opened was the absence or supposed absence of Gary Sanchez, who is reported to have agreed to a deal over a week ago, but has not still officially signed on the dotted line. So, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about Gary Sanchez last week, and it turns out he's not even official yet. He's not on the roster. So Jay Google has another question here asking, have we seen anything about the Sanchez reported signing? Do you anticipate them bringing anyone else in for spring training, or do you wait to see who gets cut? So Ryan, thoughts on this, I guess, semi weird situation here.
Yeah. I mean, Heyman was the one who reported it, and for all of Heyman's faults, he usually gets stories right. You know, your random San Francisco getting Aaron Judge.
Yeah.
Aside from your random Aaron Judge incident, usually Heyman is credible on this stuff, and other people were reporting it. Robert Murray apparently said something on a video appearance somewhere, like saying that, the terms had been agreed to, everybody was proceeding with this, and then it just hasn't materialized. Like, it hasn't been finalized. So we don't know what's going on, if this is some sort of a health thing that is holding this up or what exactly the problem is. But as of right now, it still hasn't happened. And I would think the longer this goes on, the more you'd have to be skeptical it's going to happen, right? Like,
sure,
it should have happened by now, and so something weird is definitely up with this signing.
Related to that, JD is asking on Patreon, if the Sanchez deal does not happen, who do you see most likely being the backup catcher? Is it Haas, Caro, or Nola? So Spencer, what do you think? Yeah, not a lot of great options right there.
I kind of resigned to the fact that it was going to be Haas or Nola a few weeks ago, so I guess I go back to that. Haas is the one with the split deal between the majors, minors, so I would lean towards him. Mm-hmm. I will say when the Sanchez news broke, I'd kind of figured that was, at the very least, it made it a lot less likely that we saw Caro until maybe September this year. I think if you start the year with either Haas or Nola, you're going to end up seeing Caro earlier in the season, because I don't see either of them working out. But I don't think he makes the roster out of spring. I would be pretty shocked if they kept him on the roster all year just to be a backup. I think they can make it work with Caro and Contreras kind of splitting at bats. I think we might have talked about that on here last time I was on here, actually. But he's not making the major league roster to be a backup out of spring training. So my guess would be Haas. Honestly, my gut instinct is still telling me that Sanchez is going to end up signing. And it's going to be more of like an incentive-laden deal of some sort, because my guess, and my educated guess, I guess, is he hurt that wrist at the end of last year. The Brewers got their physical. They ran this physical. They're a little concerned about the wrist or something along those lines. And they're trying to build in a little bit more safety and non-guaranteed money. into the deal by changing the terms a little bit. And I think that probably happens more than we even know about, but you kind of never know when the deal gets broken versus where it actually is in the process. Robert Murray actually said he had the deal early that morning that John Heyman broke it, but he couldn't get anybody to confirm it. And he said, when that's happening, it's usually a concern about a physical or something. And he said that the day it happened. Mm-hmm. So that makes me wonder if the Brewers never really fully agreed. And it just was kind of like, yeah, it sounds like it's about to. And I don't know. There's a lot of weird things to it, but my gut instinct tells me he is going to end up signing and being the backup catcher. But if it's not, I'd say Haas.
Yeah, I think I totally agree there. Caro is a guy for the second half at the earliest. That's not a thing you're doing out of camp. It would really be a surprise if that were to happen. You just don't see that many 20, 21-year-old catchers in the big leagues, though apparently we're maybe going to see one with Ethan Salas sometime in either this year or next year, which is just insane to me. Can't believe that's happening. But anyways, I think it's Haas, and I didn't realize last week, I should have mentioned that on the podcast, I didn't realize it was a split contract. I was talking about the fact that it was likely to release him, and that, yeah, because it's a split contract, they wouldn't have to do that. That's the nice part about those. I am hoping the Sanchez thing gets done because I think it is a helpful move for them, but yeah, we're in limbo, and it does feel like it's a health thing having to do with that broken wrist, and who knows how that's actually going to get sorted out. The fact nobody else has jumped on it and has, you know, brought him in, and because, you know, the Brewers wouldn't be the only team that could use a backup catcher with, you know, some pop and underrated defense. Clearly a lot of other teams could use that too. The fact nobody else has jumped on him either tells me that, yeah, I think we're in limbo here for a little while.
Yeah, definitely worth monitoring over the next week or so as well. Moving on, this past week, we also saw the Journal Sentinel publish a Q&A with Mark Adonazio, marking his 20 years since he bought the team. Hard to believe it's been that long already. But they did a sit-down interview with him to kind of mark the occasion and talk about the past two decades. There was some criticism of the piece online since it was pretty much a feature piece. It didn't really touch on the tough subjects. But we have a couple of ownership-related questions on Patreon here. Kind of stemming from that conversation, or at least, you know, adjacent to that article. So Mark Podskarby is asking, the Brewers seem to be investing a ton into new facilities across their organization, an updated spring training complex, a new facility in the Dominican Republic, a new facility in Carolina. Appleton just underwent major renovations, etc. So how much credit, if any, should the Brewers organization get for their investment into developing young players? And how does this compare to teams across Major League Baseball? So, Ryan, I guess let's just start with you. You know, obviously, a lot of money poured into non-Major League avenues. And you know, that's kind of gotten some criticism in that, like, doesn't mean you can't do both. But obviously, the Brewers have made a conscious decision here to kind of or resources into player dev.
Yeah, I think that's 100% true. And it's where you're going to get the best return on investment, for sure. This is every dollar you plow into player development is going to pay back more as long as you're getting those prospects to turn out. And they have been now in the last few years. Keith Law just had them ranked as the number two farm system in baseball, and other organizations, I haven't seen them putting out their actual final farm rankings here, but they're going to be in everybody's top five. So you're just going to see, I think maybe Longenhagen had him like fifth, maybe it was Kylie McDaniel had him fifth. Yeah. So it is working from that perspective. And yeah, this is what they needed to do this in terms of the Dominican development, because they had been playing at Salomon Torres's place for a long time. They needed to get a state-of-the-art facility for themselves down there, and they have that now. They own Carolina, so that, you know, putting new facilities and things in there, it's part of the deal. When you own the team, like, that's part of the deal. Appleton, I'm not sure. They don't own Appleton the same way that they own the Mudcats. So those renovations, I don't know who's necessarily responsible for those. So how much credit you want to give? I mean, some, but I mean, obviously they still came out hat in hand asking for $500 million of public money for the Major League Stadium over the next 30 years or so, a little bit, even less. So I don't know how much credit like you can give other than just to say, like, I think they are investing at a comparable, if not better level than other teams in baseball in terms of in developing things. And as far as the major league side goes, they're everybody's begging for public money. The Royals stadium that I was just talking this week about that. And looks like they're asking for a mere $1 billion for their stadium. There had been rumors that they were possibly seeking as much as $5 billion in development, but it's only going to be $1 billion. So for them to put the,
what a steal.
Yeah. What a steal. Yeah. Just, yeah. Pure altruism. So there's that. So unfortunately, the way it works is, and this is not limited to baseball in any way, shape, or form, rich people demand in the United States that their stadiums be subsidized by taxpayer dollars. And in most cases, they get their wish in one form or another, whether it's directly coming from taxpayer dollars or there's some sneaky backdoor way of doing it where there's tax breaks and incentives and things like that. They pretty much all get their money and they pretty much all get their taxpayer dollars one way or another to do this stuff. And that's just how it works. So it's really a tough situation because it's, I personally find that terrible, but it's also just the standard way that things operate.
It's the way things operate unless you're John Fisher, which LOL.
Oh,
good. Anyway,
Lord almighty. That situation is like the guy eating popcorn and bouncing around, like gleefully watching that situation. That was literally me when I saw that. I was like, this is the best thing. That deal was falling apart with Las Vegas and now they're crawling back to Oakland is just, oh, it's so great.
And probably Sacramento. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
All right. All right. Moving on, another question about ownership. And this one is one of the ones that we couldn't get to last week, so we're doing it this week. It comes from, you're either a smart fella or a fart smella. And they're asking perhaps a meta question regarding the overall state of things, but is it just me or has there been a really an uptick in cynicism from fans towards the organization in spite of how relatively good they've been for a while now? I'll compare it to how things were earlier in Mark Adonazio's ownership tenure when the Brewers were mostly bad, but most people still seem to have fun with it. I would myself concede that the current roster construction strategy, while clearly effective, hyper commodifies players like they're simply assets and is less fun to root for, at least to the more casual fan in me. Am I valid in feeling this way? Has the organization otherwise simply killed a lot of goodwill with fans despite relative success? Were the more cynical fans always there, but now they simply have a platform in a way that they didn't have so much previously? It just feels like we as a collective fan base are in a kind of weird place at the moment. So definitely, I feel like arguing's always kind of gone on Brewers Twitter, at least, and dating back to, you know, message board days. But Spencer, do things kind of feel especially polarized now to you, according, you know, to some fans and what the fan base is feeling?
Yes. yes to almost every question that was asked in that entire thing. I think that there is a huge uptick in people just, I think there have always been complainers and people who were cynical and people who didn't believe in the team. And I do think there's absolutely way more of a platform for those people now. So I'll say it this way. I enjoy how the Brewers build their roster. Like the way they cycle through players, like that's fun to me. That's how I think about baseball. I fully understand why people who don't think that way don't enjoy watching some of their favorite players go and some of their people that they've been watching for 5 years now, they're on the trade block and the Brewers are just trying to kind of cycle them through. I fully understand why that isn't fun for everybody. But that's just how I enjoy watching a team get built. And I think it's what the Brewers have to do in order to be their best and be competitive long-term, which is their goal.
Yeah. 100% agree with you on all that.
I do think for me where people, I always wonder, I keep seeing this on Twitter, people saying, the Brewers keep losing all these. They're just going to lose blank in 6 years. I can't think of stars that the Brewers brought up and lost except for Hader and Burns recently. Like Braun was extended through his whole career. Lucroy and Gomez wasn't brought up, but he basically was, were extended through their primes. Yelich, they extended. Like, these are the two real examples of guys who came up and they weren't able to bring back, and then Woodruff's another, but that's a completely different circumstance. Corbin Burnes is trying to be the highest paid player in the history of baseball for a pitcher. The Brewers shouldn't and can't do that. Josh Hader is trying to get paid $100 million, or he got pretty much $100 million as what is now a closer, a three-inning or a three-out closer. He might go back to his old role now that he got paid. We know that, but that's not nearly as valuable as it was. And I get why people don't love seeing those guys go, and it is hard to see those guys go. To me, I don't get where people get this idea that the Brewers just lose all their good players. Like, they don't.
Yeah.
CC was a half-year rental, and then he left for free agency. Like, that doesn't count. That was, he was brought in knowing he was a rental. Greinke, they obviously flipped. But, like, over the years, they've kept the players that they brought up and did well. So I find that weird. I've always found it weird.
Yeah, I have a list that I trot out all the time about this. That it's, you look at the guys that came in and were developed by the Brewers, drafted and developed by the Brewers, and since Marco Attanasio took over, the all-stars who have been basically extended through their useful life as players would be Ben Sheets, Bill Hall, Ricky Weeks, J.J. Hardy, or sorry, J.J. Hardy is one of the exceptions, Corey Hart, Ryan Braun, Jonathan Lucroy, Carlos Gomez, kind of, he came over a little bit later, but ended up signing an extension, basically took him through his useful life as a player. And now in this era, you have guys like Christian Yelich, who's been extended. That is a bit of a weird situation, but he obviously has been extended forever. So that's, you know, whatever. And then Freddie Peralta and now Jackson Chourio. Really, the exceptions to this in this entire era in terms of guys who were let go and not kept, who made all-star teams and were home developed by the Brewers. J.J. Hardy, who was let go because he was having a terrible season, and the team had Alcides Escobar behind him, and they got Carlos Gomez for him. So that was a weird situation. Prince Fielder, they let go because, you know, he wanted a huge, huge pile of money, and the Brewers obviously didn't want to invest in him long-term. He ends up getting a huge contract, and most of that contract ended up getting paid off by insurance companies because Prince Fielder had to retire at, like, what was it, 31, 32 years old? Yeah, because 32. He broke down. And now we have this next group, and it's Josh Hader and it's Corbin Burnes, and obviously Brandon Woodruff was another situation, but obviously the injury complicated all that. But really, for the most part, the Brewers under Marco Attanasio in his now 20 years have not had this huge string of, like, useful players that they just let go and didn't extend. Much more often than not, when a guy became a good player for them, they extended them, you know, through basically their useful life as a player. And I bring that up because people, like, there's like residual memory about this that people get mad at, like, they let Jonathan Lucroy go. Go take a look at what Jonathan Lucroy was after he left the Brewers. It was never any good. Like, they got out at exactly the right time on that. They got out at exactly the right time on Carlos Gomez, too. They have a habit of doing that, of getting out at the right time on guys. And I understand that that can sometimes lead to frustration and whatever. But I think more than anything, just to go back to the main question here, it's right now is always going to be a tricky time because when you're going through a transitional period like this, it's going to be tough. And I think part of me would say, oh, well, it would have been better if they'd, like, won a World Series or something. But I actually don't think that's true the more I think about it, because I watch the Bucks. And people are miserable about the Bucks, and they have their championship. But what's going on this season is still making people miserable. They're completely disappointed in the team because it's not doing as well as they had hoped. And so it's really frustrating and aggravating, and everybody's very upset about it. I see it all the time on Twitter. And so I kind of feel like, well, no, if the Brewers had won the World Series in 2021 or whatever, and they were still going through this exact same thing where they were, you know, shipping out Corbin Burnes and had, you know, traded away Josh Hader and were setting themselves up for the future, I don't think it would actually be all that different right now. I think that a transitional period like this is always tough because people, they're used to the players that were on the team and they can't see that there's just uncertainty. The future, even if you have a top farm system like they do, the future just represents this uncertainty and this nebulousness, and people get really uncomfortable with uncertainty and don't like it. And so I think sort of regardless of what had happened in the past, people would be angsty right now about where the team is at, because there's a lot of change and a lot of upheaval going on with what is going on in the roster. So I don't know. It's kind of part of the natural cycle of things where people, when teams go through transition like this, it's difficult and people get upset, but I don't think it's all that avoidable. And I think you're 100% right, because they're basically, I've said this before on here, they're running the team largely the way I want it to be run, with, you know, the proviso that they could be a little bit more investment in it would be probably helpful, but I don't even know how much of that would necessarily help, because they're already picking most of the low-hanging fruit that's out there. You know, they're the good deals that are available for them to do, they're doing those things. So what they might add to it, maybe they would spend, you know, $80 million on a Kyle Schwarber, and maybe that would help somewhat in the short term and probably hurt in the long term. And so, yeah, I don't know. This is one of those questions where it's just, it really is just a matter of what people decide to consider important and what they want out of a team. And I agree with you 100% in that the way I follow baseball too, I like having transactions. I like having churn. I like seeing, you know, new things happening. And honestly, they've had, for the most part, during this time period, like I said, they've had guys who've been franchise stalwarts, people who've been around for a decade or more throughout this entire time period. Like, they've had guys who've been around long term, and then supplementing it with guys from the outside as well. So I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things. We're in that phase of things right now where there's angst and disappointment. And frankly, a lot of it does go back to the playoff exits, the early playoff exits.
Exactly.
That they've had.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that's, I think, where many people are, you know, getting rubbed the wrong way. You know, obviously, yes, unprecedented stretch of regular season success, which, you know, it's 5 or 6 seasons, which also says a lot about the history of the Brewers, frankly. But, you know, it's the fact that, okay, they haven't taken the next step. And that's natural part of being a fan, right? I think, like, you can have sustained success and sustained regular season success, and Ryan, I know you prefer regular season success and take your chances in the playoffs, but also, frankly, it sucks to see them get swept in the first round every year. And I know semantically it's not swept every year, but like it stinks to see them go one and done without much fight, you know. And I think that's where the idea that it would be nice to see the team do more, you know, spend on the edges, or, you know, it's very difficult, as we've talked about through the years, right, to get that extra 1 or 2 war to put you over the top compared to, you know, the 5 or 6 war to put you in contention, right? And yeah, that's kind of where they're stuck at right now, and that's kind of where they're hitting their heads on, whether it's self-imposed or not, this glass ceiling, right? Like, it's really hard to break through and get those extra 2 or 3 pieces. Hopefully, the farm system being as it is right now provides some of that. But I really can't blame a lot of people for, you know, seeing the way the team's been run the last 4 or 5 years and seeing the playoff exits and just thinking, maybe let's try something else.
Well, yeah. It gets stale and people want something different in that sense.
Right.
But it ultimately comes down to, you're talking about a matter of a few games and them hinging on, you know, random weirdness and just things happening where you're like, and there is also a certain thing here where, like, Corbin Burnes, who is supposed to be the guy that we're all mad is leaving because this is the homegrown ace that we've been searching for forever, hasn't exactly covered himself in glory in the postseason. Like, he hasn't been the stalwart that has helped carry
them. Same with Hader, right? Hader blew the wild card game that they were up against Max Scherzer and the Nats and blew that one right open. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it's just because playoff baseball is so, it's by its nature, it's small samples and it's so random. You can't really read anything into it, but, like, it just, it sucks because this has been a good period for the team, and they have done so much more right than what they have done wrong. They've been so close and have had, you know, things going and hitting on all these, especially now that the farm system is producing, they're hitting on so many cylinders at the moment, and it's, things are really, really good, but they just can't get those playoff victories. And that's all that seems to matter. That's all at this point. And I think it's a matter of raised expectations, right? People had their expectations raised every year in this time period where they would, the team would usually outproduce what people were expecting. People would go in, and we, the nerds, would kind of be sitting here going, you know, Pecota really likes this team and they think they're a playoff team. And most people are like, no, this team isn't that good. And then lo and behold, they'd end up in the playoffs. And then there was usually, aside from 2018, there was usually, you know, a pretty quick unceremonious exit. Well, there were every year after that, a quick unceremonious exit. And so it's a constant situation of getting hopes up and dashed, getting hopes up and dashed. And at some point that does like wear on people to the point, right, where I think there are people who would seem to prefer, like, they would just be bad and not, so they wouldn't have to get their hopes up. They could just tune it out and not have to pay attention and just be bad so that you don't have to care. That might be, you know, unfortunately, that might be what's coming this year. So we'll see. We'll see exactly how that works.
All right. We still have a lot of questions to get to, so let's move on. LaCroix Suitcase has the next one asking, as spring training starts, what information are you looking forward to learning about the team in the weeks before games start? So I guess kind of along those lines, a lot of unknowns with a very young team. But Spencer, I guess specifically, you know, if you tune into some of these spring training games or you read the camp reports, what are you looking for?
I'm looking to see if Sal Frehley can handle the infield. No.
I mean, now I am. Yeah.
That will be something I'm watching for sure. I love spring mostly just for the younger players to watch what's going on with them. Tyler Black, especially, a guy who's kind of, could he make the roster? Might he be the third baseman? Who knows? I want to see how he looks in spring. I'd love to see some Mizorowski on major league mound a couple times, see how that goes. But mostly, I mean, I'm going to be watching the pen a lot. I think there's so many non-optionable guys and so many people that they have to choose from for that eight man pen. I'm just going to be seeing who looks good. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be health that factors in at some point. Somebody's going to have some arm stuff going on in spring. It happens every year and it makes those decisions a little bit easier, but that to me is kind of the roster crunch, is the pen more than anything else. And then also, I mean, there's a lot of starter options, a lot of people they're at least looking at as potential starters, so I'm curious how they're going to kind of flesh that out, if they might look at it as like a piggyback type situation at the end of the rotation, or if they go five or six man, or if one of the starting options all of a sudden starts throwing inning or two stints in spring. Like, that's the stuff I look for. Results aren't going to matter to me that much. I watched Keston Hira go absolutely crazy in spring training for multiple years. Pitchers are not pitching as they would in the regular season in spring training, so I hesitate to value the results, especially on the hitting side, more than anything else, because pitchers will go out there and say, I'm throwing all changeups as my secondary today because that's what I'm working on. And I'm going to throw only high fastballs because that's what I'm working on. And it makes it really hard to judge real results, but I just like to see how people kind of the look and the feel of things as they go through it.
Yeah. I'll keep this simple. I'm going to be watching Jackson Chourio and specifically a few things. One, I want to see what his strikeout rate looks like. That's going to be a good indicator on how ready he is. If he is whiffing a lot and racking up Ks, it's one thing that you can kind of tell from spring training stats. There's not a lot good that comes out of spring training stats, but strikeout to walk ratios are somewhat useful, especially on the pitching side, but also as far as hitters go. And also, I want to see barreling up baseballs. You know, hitting it out of the park, good, yes, hopefully. But just like hitting the ball hard against good big league pitching. I want to see him doing it against some good league pitching, and I want to see him playing to start games or playing with the starters is kind of what I want to see. I don't care what he does in the sixth inning against some guy who's in double A. Like that, I know he can crush those guys. What I want to see is how he does against starters and relievers as they're getting ramped up and ready to go. That's what I care about.
All right. Adam Post, next question, asking, since we've all been speculating about it since the Burns trade, what would a realistic return in a Willy Adames trade look like? So, Spencer, I guess if they were to trade Willy Adames now, what do you want in return?
I think it kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier. I think you need some high level pitching prospect type, maybe even a like recent major leaguer or something. So I think that's what it would have to look like. I personally, I don't see it happening before the season, at least in a Willy trade. I know a lot of people have been expecting it. I honestly think they are planning to go into the season with him and take the qualifying offer if they're having a good season, and they'll be fine with it. But the Dodgers would always still feel like the team that lines up with what they have and what we would be looking for, which is just young starters. So if it happens, that's the team I'd be looking at.
I literally have their prospect ranks open right now. Nick Frasso and Gavin Stone, come on down.
Yes.
Those, I would love to see one of those two guys be a target, along with one of their numerous other young pitchers that they have out there. Plenty of guys like that out there as well. Yeah, those would be the guys. And I also agree. The last time I said this about Corbin Burns was like, oh yeah, well, they're not trading him. And then they did. So if I say, okay, well, right. Yeah, I think we're going to go into, cause that's where I'm at right now, is I think they probably are going to keep Willie and go into the season. And, you know, if they fall out of it, then trade him at the deadline. I think that would be a perfectly reasonable plan with a shortstop as opposed to a starting pitcher where there's a lot more inherent risk. But I've been wrong about this before, so whatever. Nick Frasso, Gavin Stone, come on down.
I guess semi-related to that, Drew G is asking, I know we already have 7 or 8 starters, but only one anyone can feel remotely confident in at the moment. Would Hyunjin Ryu be worth adding to that mix, or do you think it just further bury the younger arms that we may want to see? Personally, I'd love this on a 1 or 2 year deal. I think the ground ball percentage in front of this defense could really play up, and it might be the only team in the league where he could sign and slot in as a number 2 starting pitcher. Ryan, your thoughts on Ryu?
I was just looking this up, and there's some weird stuff. I'm not sure. I think he's still potentially trying to get signed. I don't know exactly what's going on there. I'm reading a Korean article where it says he's going to be transferred to the Kansas City Royals. Like, this is a soccer deal. I don't know exactly what's going on with this. I did mention Hyunjin Ryu a few weeks ago, that he would be somebody I would be interested in, and it seems like it would be a perfectly cromulent placeholder and guy to help lengthen the rotation. I'm not real worried about blocking guys. I think that stuff will sort itself out relatively quickly. That's not a huge concern of mine. So that would be fine, but I don't know. Does he have any interest in coming to the Brewers? Like, I have no idea.
I don't know. Yeah. It could be Yolis Chacini, you know, throwing back to 2018, maybe just get a weird random good year out of him. We'll see. Ian Pomplin has the next question, asking, is Abner Uribe poised for a breakout year? I think he's one of the most underrated pitchers on the team at this point. Spencer, your thoughts on Abner and what he could do?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like when he came up, he kind of broke out in the eyes of most people. I mean, everyone saw the stuff. It was all over Pitching Ninja every time he pitched. I could see, I mean, to me, he is the future closer, barring maybe Mizorowski moving to the pen. But I guess I do have some concerns about like a sophomore slump of some sort, just because of the command and possibly players just laying off of his pitches more often or making him find the zone. I think back to Devin Williams in, that would have been 21, after his huge, like his really good COVID year. And then he came back and teams just kind of said, all right, we're not swinging at the changeup because it's going to land outside of the zone. And then he started throwing way more fastballs. He kind of found a mix between the two, and that was how he evened it out and was fine. I wonder if teams are just going to say, hey, we're taking until we put him in at least you get a strike called against you. And they also know that there's a bit of a temper and a bit of a right. mindset concern with him at times, I think. So I think if he does start to struggle, you could kind of see it spiral. I'm not anticipating that. I do think he's going to have a really good year, but it's in the back of my mind that there is a bit of a chance of him. There will always be a bit of a chance of him kind of falling apart at any moment. But he did. I will say this, having watched him as much as I did in the minors, he controlled himself in terms of being able to get past mistakes or get past anything way better than he did in the minors. Once he came up to MLB. I mean, we saw it. The two times he blew up were he came in for Chafin in the extra innings after Chafin walked everybody and just continued walking everybody himself. And then game two of that wild card series, he punched the mound in that one. So that was a pretty good sign that he was not handling his anger very well at that moment. But I mean, the stuff is unbelievable, and I would expect him to be a high leverage pitcher for the Brewers. So I think there's a very good chance he does break out and has a really, really good season as well.
Yeah, I mean, he is putting up some absolutely filthy numbers. Like last year, even with the command struggles, he still put up a 1.17 whip. And if he can get the command kind of figured out and settled down, that's going to go way up. His whiff percentages, all these things were very, very high. The K percentages, whiff percentages, percentiles, he's, you know, up in the 90s here. Like, it's really, really good. He's not allowing a lot of barrels. If he can get the command figured out, yeah, there's no reason why he can't break out and turn into a super exciting pitcher, just because you saw it. It's like he's throwing bowling balls out there. He's one of those guys. Reminds me of Felix Bautista for the Orioles, yeah. Where everything he throws, the batters just seem to be super uncomfortable. Even when they make contact with him, it's like, it's always going to be like, did it break the bat?
Stingers. It's not fun to get stung on a 102 sinker, right? Yeah. Right. It just sucks.
Exactly. Bowling balls. He is out there throwing bowling balls. And so if he can figure out the command part of it, which, yes, granted, he really, really, really struggled with the walks. He needs to get that under control. But, you know, he's a 23-year-old reliever who throws 100 plus miles an hour. Those guys usually come with control issues when they're young. That's part of the deal. And his control doesn't need to be immaculate for him to be really, really good, because he misses so many bats that he can afford to work some deep counts and be okay. Josh Hader certainly did, and was, you know, there were times when it felt like you were walking a tightrope with him, and he's as good as it gets. So it's part of the deal with relief pitchers who miss a lot of bats. They're usually going to carry some command risk.
Devin Williams walks a bunch of guys too. Honestly,
Yep. He walks. Yeah, definitely. He walks too many guys for what you would like to see. And yeah, it obviously he's still extremely successful.
All right. Sticking with the bullpen, Bryce Trozen has our next question, asking, I asked about Vieira last week, but I'll ask Spencer about how you think the back half of the bullpen will do this season. I have a feeling the pen is going to get a lot of work in this year, and everyone's going to rack up a lot of innings, so hopefully they're serviceable. So I think, based on the phrasing, Price means back end, as in back end of the depth chart and not the late inning guys. So I guess, Spencer, with that in mind, how do you feel about kind of the middle relief options here?
Well, I think there's a ton of them. They have a lot of options, and they always do, and they always build up this depth. They are in a tough spot this year. There are a lot of pitchers who I find pretty interesting that don't have options available to go down to AAA. I think maybe my hottest take about the roster right now is that I don't see Elvis Baguero making the roster out of spring. I think he's going to start in AAA because he has options. And they traded for a couple guys this offseason, like Taylor Clark and Brian Hudson. They have options. They're not making the roster out of spring. Health could change things. Obviously, injuries could change things. But they have a lot of guys in that range who are out of options. I mean, they signed Joe Ross. I don't see him starting with the amount of pitchers they brought in now. And I think June is starting. I think Ross is probably, honestly, he's very similar to like Elvis Baguero in terms of stuff. He's probably filling that role, and maybe as a longer guy, because like they were talking about in the question, I think the relievers are going to have to fill more innings. And last year it was kind of Bryce Wilson, and that was it in terms of more than two innings, maybe. Like, you could get some guys through two innings, but Bryce Wilson was your long-ish guy. I think Joe Ross is probably also going to be a longer guy this year who can help fill a 3-4 inning stint if you need it. Vieira, who we brought up, is a good arm. I would love to see a way to get more chances to watch him and see how he does in MLB, because the stuff is really, really good. But he's out of options. JB Bukauskas, who
Hold on. I have Vieira with three options left.
Really?
Spotrac. Yeah. I went and looked this up now. It looks like he has three options left. So
Fangraphs was showing zero.
Huh. Okay. Yeah, this is looking a little bit weird, because now I'm looking at it like they have Joey Weimer as having three options left, and they had to have burned an option on him last year, right? I'm not sure exactly what's going on here. Some of these have been updated. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure on that.
I mean, a lot of people who come over from overseas sign contracts where they don't have options anymore, like Colin Ray did, where he was supposed to, or not Colin Ray, who am I thinking? Somebody a couple years ago signed a deal where we all thought he had an option, but he didn't because it was worked into his contract when he came back over. So I wonder if that was the case for Vieira once he got added to the 40 man. But JB Bukauskas, who I find interesting, is another arm that I would love to see them get a chance to use, but he's also out of options. So there's just a lot of people who are kind of in that mix, and I think they're going to have success as long as they just filter through the ones who don't work and get to the ones who are showing signs of helping. So a lot of options available.
Yeah, they're going to churn through a lot of relievers this year. They have to churn through a lot of relievers. They always do. So this is obviously going to be part of the deal of what they do. I think that you might see some more middle relievers chewing up innings in a way that you were talking about, like Bryce Wilson being the only guy last year. If DL Hall doesn't make the rotation, which I'm sort of expecting, I could see him being a guy that gets a bunch of innings in the middle. If Jacob Junis, if that doesn't work out and they decide they want him to be more of a once to two times through the order than actually going two to three times and starting, I could see him being a guy that ends up doing a lot of that. Mizrowski later in the year could be a guy that comes up and, you know, they say, look, we're going to let you go like Hader did early on. We're going to let you go for 45 pitches. Take us as far as you can in that. And, you know, sometimes that ended up being like three innings because he just clowned people. So I think that we could see a lot of that with this team, but that's going to involve a lot of moving around, and they do have to deal now with that five times up and down rule that MLB put in to stop teams like the Brewers from running things this way. So they need an even larger selection of guys to draw from in this way.
All right. Let's move on to the farm system. Steve S. asking about Keith Law, one of the many who released their top prospect lists. So Keith Law just released his top Brewers prospect list, Steve says. Well, you can comment on it as you see fit. One talking point that jumped out to me is his discussion of Tyler Black. He implied he would be a center fielder if he wasn't in Milwaukee. Do you have the same impression? And if so, how does he compare to the other outfield options, e.g. Mitchell, Frelich, etc.? I don't know about you guys, but granted, I haven't paid a lot of attention to Tyler Black, but he seemed like infield only destination and like never really considered an outfielder. I guess, Ryan, any more insight on that?
Well, it's because the Brewers have had so many outfielders. Every time he's been playing with like legitimately great outfield options the whole way up. Because he's largely been with, you know, with Mitchell at times, and he's been with Weimer and with Frelich, and so he's been coming up with these guys and has largely been on the infield, but he has taken some, he's played a little bit in the outfield. There's been a little bit of that, not any significant amount. Yeah. And another team, I think you would like stick him in left field and forget it and just be like, yeah, hey, look, you would be a really, really, he could be an insanely good left fielder because he would be super fast for the position. The arm wouldn't be an issue, where it obviously is an issue in right. And I think center fielders, I prefer my center fielders to have big arms because there's so many throws being made from deep in the hole there that having a big arm in center is really nice, especially when you have guys that do have big arms like Joey Weimer, obviously showed that. So I prefer having big arms there. But yeah, this is a situation where in another system, in another team, he probably would have already been moved, I think, to left field. And that's just not really a thing you would do here. So people have speculated that maybe he would be better off being moved to a different team for that reason. But I think the bat is good enough that it's going to play potentially at first base, which I think is ultimately where he ends up.
Special thoughts on Tyler Black?
Yeah, for me, actually, 2 years ago when he was in Appleton, he did spend a decent amount of time in the outfield that year. And I saw him play out there a few times, and I immediately, I may have tweeted it. I know I wrote it down somewhere that I think he's an outfielder, and I think that is where he should be. And I genuinely do believe he could handle center field. He's good out there. It's actually pretty impressive how quickly he took to it and how good he looked out there. The issue is definitely that it's the Brewers that he's with right now. And we talked about that logjam already. It would be kind of funny if Seifert ended up in the infield and Tyler Black was an outfielder, but I really do think it wouldn't shock me if down the road, say Mitchell and Weimer don't work out and Yelich does become like a DH and all these other, like I could see Tyler Black playing a year of infield here and then all of a sudden moving to the outfield in the future. And it wouldn't surprise me. I think it would work out pretty well. I do think first is probably his best position on the infield in the end. I agree with that. I will say on the third base talk, he improved a lot because before the season I had said I didn't think he could ever play a major league third base. And watching him play, I got to the point where we talked about Monasterio a little bit. I thought he was at least the same level of defender as Monasterio. And to me, that was playable. And if the bat's a lot better than Monasterio, like it could be, that's a pretty playable third baseman. I wouldn't love it. I don't think it's the best situation for him, but it might be the best situation for the Brewers. So I think you could almost see a Ben Zobrist type of career for him too, where he's moving around third, second, some left field, getting in the lineup every day by playing all over the place. So a lot of ways they could use him, but I do think the outfield defense is legit. I think he is a legitimate outfielder.
Yep.
All right. Turning to MLB Pipeline, Devin Bearwolf asking about that, saying, looking at MLB Pipeline's new top 100 prospect rankings, they upped Churio's arm to a 50 grade, making him a true five-tool player. Looking at his tool grades, he kind of reminds me of Carlos Gomez. If Churio's career mimicked Carlos Gomez's, would you be happy or disappointed? This is an interesting one because, Ryan, we had the question, you know, maybe like a month or so ago, kind of just looking at career war totals and like, would this be a good career for Jackson Churio or not? Carlos Gomez, kind of an interesting test case where, you know, maybe the longevity wasn't there, but the peak was pretty good.
Yeah. So looking at Carlos Gomez's career, he put up a career 25.9 Fangraphs war. I don't think you could get upset about that if that's what he ends up being. Now, it's condensed in a very short period because he didn't really become a good player until he was 25. He went through those years of struggle with Minnesota. Well, first with the Mets and then with Minnesota and then one pretty mediocre year with Milwaukee in 2010, where he was really just a replacement, a defensive replacement and a pinch runner. 2011, he starts to take off, and then he becomes a really, really good player in 2013, 2014. But then just as soon as that came, it kind of throttles down. But if you look at it overall, if he's a 6.5 win player at his peak as like a 27-year-old, and he puts up 26 career war, I don't think you would be justified in being disappointed by that, but you still would be, right? Like it would be one of those situations where you'd go, yeah, I was hoping for more though. I think it's kind of like the Ricky Weeks thing where it's like, you look at his career and you go, yeah, that's fine for a career. Like that's, you shouldn't expect, you know, leaps and bounds more than that but you still kind of do because of the pedigree that was there and how highly touted the player was. I think you would be disappointed by it, but I don't know that you necessarily should be. So it's, that it's a perfect comp in that, because you could see the career playing out in a lot of ways like that, where it takes time for him. If he doesn't hit right away, where it could potentially take him some time to do that, you could see that maybe happening. But boy, I obviously hope that that's not what happens and he just hits the ground running and is a superstar from day one. But, you know, that's going to be us managing our expectations of Jackson Churio this year is going to be a constant battle.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard it here before, you know, like expectations are just premeditated resentments, right? So there you go. It'll just be, I'm fascinated by this and how soon he'll be up. And yeah, just the reaction when he inevitably, you know, struggles a little bit at 20 years old in the major leagues. I think that'll be the important thing to remember. But yeah, I mean, Carlos Gomez, one of my favorite Brewers of all time. So I would be hard pressed to be upset with that. But also, you know, 10-year contract, I would hope to get more than 25 WAR out of it. So I don't know. Okay. My Only Lemonade asking, 'tis the season for dream scenarios, and I'm in the mood for a quick fix to this middle-of-the-road Brewers roster. If the Brewers ever make it to the World Series, there's a good chance it'll resemble Arizona's creaky season of good luck and a 99th percentile performance from a young star. So, let's imagine the Zips roster projections are accurate, except that Jackson Churio hits his ceiling and produces somewhere in the range of 2023 Corbin Carroll. What would the addition of a 6-win player to the do to the Brewers' chances at postseason success? Spencer, I think it would be pretty good if Jackson Churio was a 6-win player right away.
I would agree. I think that would go pretty well. I think when you look back at the Brewers' years that they did perform well in the playoffs, every year they kind of had that superstar, that MVP-level player. I think having that in the middle of your order, or in the order, wherever he is, at the top of the order, in the middle, does completely change the outlook of a lineup and the way that pitchers have to attack a lineup. And now they're pitching around somebody. Even in 2018, like, Yelich didn't have a great postseason run that year. He did well in the Rocky series. He didn't have a good NLCS, but there's still that level of they're afraid to pitch to him and they don't want to go at him. So he took some walks in that series that were just products of them not wanting to go after him. And now guys behind him have opportunities to drive him in. Like, having that bat that does kind of worry a team or scare pitchers, I think, is a big deal. And if he's that level of player right away, I think there's also an energy that kind of comes with it when somebody that young is playing that well. And I think the D-backs kind of fed off of a Corbin Carroll and some of the other young guys who played well in the playoffs. As analytical as I am, I do believe in that type of stuff a little bit, where it's like there is not necessarily momentum, but a level of a team believing in themselves when things are going well like that, that can carry you. And I think a young player like that doing that does put the Brewers in a better chance to at least maybe win a playoff series for the first time since 2018. And hopefully, I mean, advance a little further than that. But no matter how the playoffs go, if Jackson Churio puts up a 6-win season as a rookie, I'm going to feel really good about the future of the Brewers no matter what. Right. So,
right. I think we kind of saw that with the Diamondbacks. It was sort of said that they're too young to know that they should be nervous in these spots. And we kind of saw it with the Packers a little bit too late in the NFL season, if you want to, you know, cross those sport divides. But Ryan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where to add, like, the actual question here was, does it make them better in the playoffs? I think you need somebody to get hot, or multiple somebodies to start carrying you through the postseason. Look back at teams that went and won the World Series, and usually they have a number of players. Sometimes it's the superstars. Then sometimes it's David Freese or Cody Ross or
Howie Kendrick.
Or, yeah, like anyone, you can start naming these guys who went on insane heaters in the postseason. Texas last year had the outfielder who just went on an all-time heater. Hey, he had a good season this year, but Adelis Garcia. Yeah, Adelis Garcia. Yeah, you're going to need somebody to get hot. And I guess you have a better chance of getting somebody hot when it's, you know, a six-win player. But you also worry about somebody like Chirio, where he would be when you get into the postseason if teams have started, you know, like smart teams, good teams that are in the postseason, maybe have started to figure him out and have started to make adjustments to him. And you don't know, like, where in the process of adjusting and adjusting back a guy might be. I think there's good reason to hope that Chirio is going to be one of those quick adjusters, guys who's able to make quick changes, because he's shown that at times in the minors where he's been able to make fairly quick adjustments and, you know, figure stuff out. But we're talking about a 20-year-old, so you don't know. But yeah, it would definitely make me feel much better about the future, as Spencer said, how much it would make me feel about going into this postseason. There's going to be so many other factors that we're watching, including like, oh, what's the state of the rotation and why, you know, wouldn't it be nice if we had Corbin Burnes here? Because that would be inevitably the thing. If the Brewers make the postseason this year, unless like Joey Ortiz is, you know, a superstar or something, or DL Hall is, you know, way better than we really expect, I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of questions come the end of the season. Like, boy, it would be great if we had Corbin Burnes on this team right now. So yeah, there's just so many different ways that this can go. But yeah, like obviously it would be great to have Jackson Chirio turn out to be a 6-win player. And he did. He carried them. The Brewer series had an 1800 OPS. And then it tapered a little bit against the Dodgers down to only 1.1. So down to 1100. But then it was under 500 in the Philly series and they still won that one. Mm-hmm. And then in the World Series, 610. So he was, you know, pretty modest after those first couple of series. But yeah. Obviously, he was very, very impactful for them last year.
Yeah, I think he also kind of had a shoulder thing late in the year, right? That might have affected that. Mm. But yeah, absolutely. Last couple of questions here. We've got one from Alex Lamers that we got last week that we'll get to now. So Alex is asking, any thoughts on this FanGraphs analysis on pitch visibility in all the ballparks that ranks American Family Field second from the bottom? This is kind of surprising to me because all we ever hear about is like how great the batter's eye is in Milwaukee. But Spencer, I guess maybe some other metrics indicate not so favorable.
Yeah, that was my first thought. I mean, visiting players, home players, pretty much everybody says, I see the ball really well here. So it's cool that they tried to quantify it. I think it's always fun when people try and do that stuff. But I'd have a hard time believing a metric over the players who actually do have to try and see the ball in the park. So I don't know. I would still be under the assumption that it's a pretty good hitter's a pretty good place to hit in terms of like the batter's eye and stuff.
Yeah. And it's weird because how they did this was looking at how accurate umpires were, right? That was, that was the way they did this. And so you're potentially introducing some noise into that equation. But yeah, like Spencer, I've always thought, oh yeah, people love hitting here. Paul Goldschmidt has talked about it, that, you know, he just sees, and obviously the numbers bear it out. He loves hitting in Milwaukee. Just is always absolutely tanked baseballs here. So that's a thing for sure. But yeah, I was surprised by it. I do wonder how much this is affected by day games. Because day games are a very different proposition
in Milwaukee. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, when that sun starts streaming in through those windows on the first base side and you start getting the weird shadows being cast, especially between home plate and the pitching mound, yeah, that definitely makes me wonder how that is. But then again, Progressive Field has some weird shadow stuff going on as well in Cleveland. Famously, you see that in the playoffs. And they were up towards the top of this list. So I don't think it's the full explanation, but yeah, this is definitely was a surprise. I was not expecting this. I missed this. And so I was surprised when I read through this.
All right. Last question we'll get to this week. Kind of more of a comment. Tricky Henderson writing on Patreon. I dig the podcast, but don't claim to know who's who by voice yet. I'm sure the Midsummer Classic I'll be hip. That said, I'd like to suggest Hot Rivets as the nickname for whomever verbed the Gary Sanchez last episode. Earning a nickname is better than dubbing oneself, says the guy who dubbed himself last January. Brewers, Brewers, and Hot Rivets keep turning up the heat. Milwaukee Brewers. So Hot Rivets, you want to say anything here?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, I actually thought when I first read this question, I thought he was talking about Gary Sanchez. And so Gary Sanchez is now going to be Hot Rivets. And I was going to try to get that, like, we'd have to start a campaign to try to get that to be his nickname on Baseball on the Reference. Page. Yeah, yeah, actually get it on. Does he have one on there? I haven't even looked at that.
I don't know. Yeah. There's some weird ones on there. I bet he's got some.
There are some really, really strange ones. Let's see. Gary Sanchez does not appear to actually have a nickname. Oh, wait. Actually does. The Kraken or the Sanchez?
The Sanchez. That must be back from the Baby Bombers days. Yeah,
that's definitely Baby Bombers days. So, yeah, I had to scroll down, but there it is. Yeah, the Kraken or the Sanchez. He's never played in Seattle, though, so, well, maybe he will.
He did a little bit. He did. I thought he did.
Did he play in
there.
Seattle?
Yeah.
Did he actually? Yeah. Nope. I'm seeing Minnesota. No? Yeah, he was with the Yankees, and then he went to Minnesota, and then that hot second with the Mets, and then the Padres. So
okay,
yeah, nothing there yet. But yeah, the Sanchez is that's better. So yeah, I guess there's worse things to be called than Hot Rivets. But
all right, well, thanks for the questions and comments on Patreon. As always, patreon.com/mke is where you can sign up for as little as $2 a month. Also, I have a couple of new patrons joining on this week. Ryan, who do we have?
I think this is a returner, Stephen Skiles. Pretty sure that we've said his name before on here and have talked about him. And then Justin Cannenberg both signed up and now get all of the content, including the Minor League Extra and Paul's Packers mini pods when those are out in the season. So yeah, thank you very much, guys. We very much appreciate it.
Absolutely. Looking forward to more folks joining the team as we get closer to opening day here. We'll, you know, keep following the Gary Sanchez saga, see if he shows up to spring training at any point or if it's announced or if he ends up on the Cubs or something. I don't know.
That would just be the biggest kick in the groin. Like, that would be the worst. You've absolutely now spoken it into existence, and now it's going to happen. Yep. And I will blame you forever for that, James.
That's fine.
If that happens,
that's
it is fine. Your fault.
The way I roll is you know, opposite thinking, reverse jinx. So hopefully that doesn't happen now. But anyway, yeah, we'll keep tabs on that situation. Keep tabs on anything else over the next week or so as we get into spring training. As always, just kind of cross our fingers that no pitchers get hurt on a week by week basis, and we'll cover anything else that comes up along the way. We're getting closer to games, so that'll be fun to talk about as well. Spencer, thanks for joining us this week. Have anything to plug? I'll pull a Paul here.
No, I mean, I do have a podcast I'm doing with my friend. You can follow us on Twitter at the Cream City Pod, Bucks and Brewers podcast. And then, I mean, if you want to follow me on Twitter, it's at smichaelis234. So that's it.
There you go. Definitely worth a follow on Twitter as well, especially when the Brewers add pitchers. Spencer's very quick to tell us if there's anything here or not, and definitely a worthy follow there. So thanks again, Spencer, for filling in. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we will be back to next time to talk about any other spring training developments, anybody else trying to play second base, that sort of thing. So have a good week, everyone. We'll see you then next time on the Walking Stick.
Fair weather, fair.